Well, happy Resurrection Day, friends. My name is Robin. I'm one of the pastors here. If we haven't yet met at the door, I would love to meet you. I hang out in the atrium after. Our pastors, Brian and Johanna, will also be there. And we just love to put a face to a name and get connected. If you have any questions, feel free to ask. I hope you found everything you needed this morning, coffee, tea, bathrooms. If you have any questions, the guest services or anyone with a lanyard. Today, if you haven't already guessed, is the pinnacle of the Christian calendar. It's the heart of our faith. It's the reason that we can have hope in such a messed up world. And it's so central, this day is so central, that every Sunday, I don't know if you knew this, every Sunday is actually a micro Easter. The early followers of Jesus worshiped, they gathered on a Saturday, the Sabbath, until the resurrection. Following the resurrection, they began to meet on Sundays, the first day of the week. And we're going to see why the first day is so critical in interpreting the resurrection, in understanding the resurrection. The so what, who cares of the resurrection. I'm not going to be defending the truth of it today, to lay out all the proofs for it. There's lots of evidence if you want to dig. We have 2,000 years of people living out of the reality of the resurrection. We have 2,000 years of people who have died for the reality, for the truth of the resurrection. What's important for us are the implications of it, the so what of the resurrection. So if you're here, maybe you've been dragged here, maybe you've been bribed here because there's a nice big meal following the service, and you don't believe in the resurrection of Jesus, I'm not going to try to convince you today. What I care about, what we should be caring about, is the so what factor, the what now factor. If you are just joining us today, we have spent as a church the last 6 weeks journeying through the last week of Jesus' life, the last days, mourning at the cross with the witnesses, hearing from the accomplices, placing ourselves in their shoes, wrestling with their very real tensions, and lamenting their regrets and their loss. And there were so many witnesses and accomplices to the crucifixion. We didn't cover them all. But each one along the way challenged us. Each one held up a mirror and asked us the question, what would you have done? What would you have done if you were in their shoes? And I got a hint for us. What we do now determines what we would have done then. If status and image is more important to us now than what's right, then we might have voted with the Sanhedrin against Jesus and condemned him to death. If security and power is more important to us now than doing what's right, we might have done what Pilate did. If we have to have control over how things happen, make things happen the way we want them to happen, we might have done what Judas did. Each witness asks us, what would you have done? Which Jesus do you follow? Today, we're going to accompany one more witness on this long journey to an ancient garden outside of a stone tomb, our feet wet with the dew of the grass, in the chill and the darkness before dawn. So I want you to come with me as the writer John takes us back, way farther back than we can imagine. Jesus has been crucified. He's been laid in this borrowed tomb. And the desperate hopes of all his followers died with him. Now they're aimlessly lost. And John writes this in John chapter 20, verse 1. Early on the first day of the week. If you brought your Bibles, if you're a paper Bible person, underline first day of the week. While it was still dark. Let's just pause here on these 13 words. They're not just a description of when this event happened. They're potent with meaning. They're atomic in their impact. They're the key to understanding the resurrection, the so what. This is John writing. For those new to the Bible, authors didn't just record history when they wrote the Bible. They were writing theology. Even when they were recounting events, it wasn't just simply a recounting of events. They were telling a story that transcended the event, that transcended the words on the page. A story that means more than actually what happened. And throughout the Bible, there's these hyperlinks, there's these dots that we connect throughout the whole story. And this is John writing. And if you'll remember, John began the account of Jesus' life with, "In the beginning." Does that sound familiar? These three words, which are just two words in the Greek, but these three words are a hyperlink. They take us back. There is only one other book in the Bible that starts with those three words, "in the beginning," and we know what it is. It's the book of Genesis. The first words of the first book of Scripture. The first words of the creation story. John is making a point here. So let's go back, way back, to Genesis 1. Here's what we read. "In the beginning, when God began to create the heavens and the earth was complete chaos and darkness." There's that word, darkness, "covered the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And then God said, 'Let there be light.' And there was light." There was darkness, and then there was light. "And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day." Underline, first day. As we stand in this garden, staring at this tomb, John is taking us way back. Back to the beginning, to the first day of the first week, when God began to push back the chaos and the darkness, and creation was born. Something's happening here in this garden that John is trying to tell us. And in the creation poem, what was God doing? The Spirit of God, that feminine nature of God, the feminine essence of God, hovered over the chaos, creating, bringing order from disorder, creating what will be Earth, this terrestrial garden where the whole biosphere is in harmony. And it was very good. This was the Creator's design. And in his opening lines, John takes us back to that primordial garden, to the beginning of time itself, and he connects the two stories. Resurrection and creation are intricately linked. So hold that thought as we go into the story today. When we read early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, we now know the subtext. John is dropping us clues. They're not very subtle. He's directing our attention somewhere. But where? Let's find out. Picking up at verse 1 in John 20, he says, "Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb, and she saw that the stone had been removed from the tomb. So she ran and she went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, 'They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they've laid him.'" Stealing a body was a really big deal. We know how sacred the body is even today. In Jewish culture, this was anathema not to have a proper burial. "Then Peter and the other disciple set out and went toward the tomb. The two were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first." Okay, you must have the win. "He bent down to look in and saw the linen wrappings lying there, but he didn't go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb. He saw the linen wrappings lying there and the cloth that had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple who reached the tomb first," this guy really wants us to know that he beat Peter, don't he? "Okay. He also went in and he saw and believed, for as they yet did not understand the scriptures that he must rise from the dead. Then the disciples returned to their homes. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb." Mary stood weeping outside the tomb for all that's lost, for her friend and her confidant, the one who rescued her from a tormented life and validated her leadership skills and gifts and gave her a place of belonging amongst the followers, gave her a reason to hope and a reason to live. By the way, it's historically inaccurate that she was a sex worker. It didn't appear until the 6th century when Pope Gregory I inserted it into a sermon, and it stuck. More on her this summer. It's just a free aside. But for her, Resurrection Sunday didn't follow right after Good Friday. What did you do yesterday? Did you gather with family? Did you run errands? Catch up on laundry? We kind of went from Good Friday service to Sunday resurrection service. We know the end of the story. She didn't. She endured an entire day in between. We call it Holy Saturday. It would have been the Sabbath for them. When she would have gone to the temple and she would have worshiped the way they do week after week, and she would have heard the prophecies and of a redeemer who was coming. She would have heard all of that recited. The Sabbath worship inspired hope, strengthened their resolve as an oppressed people. But not this Saturday. Not this Saturday. It would have been like salt in the wound. She already knew the Redeemer had come. And then they'd killed him. And here she was in the temple on a Sabbath, hearing these things again. What? You can imagine the dissonance? She'd spent 3 years believing that Jesus was the fulfillment of this. She was waiting for the emancipation of herself and her people. But all that anticipation and hope just died the day before on a cross. Likely when she was in the temple worshiping, she just went through the motions in a daze of unbelief and paralyzed by grief and wondering what she was doing there. I suspect many of you have been in that place. There she is weeping. She's just lost the person she lived for. The center of her entire belief system, all that she had hung her faith on, was nailed to a Roman cross, and her hope just laid in tatters at her feet. Have you ever experienced that? When life suddenly doesn't align with your beliefs? When what you experience... no longer fits your expectations or your understanding of God. You suffer this emotional and mental dissonance that feels like physical pain. The disillusionment and the disappointment are palpable. Our whole body is racked with pain in those times. We're left feeling unmoored. Like, where do we turn? Where do we go? Who do we look to? What now? And here she is. Sign of spring, bugs. Here she is, weeping for the loss of her loved one, for her crushed dreams of freedom from Roman oppression and for herself and her people. And she, like everyone else, expected that Jesus was the Messiah. She'd pinned her hopes on that. Rescue was on the horizon. They could taste it. It's really hard for us in a society of relative affluence and comfort and safety, to really grasp the depth of disappointment here. Those in Ukraine, in Gaza, in Cuba, in Sudan, and elsewhere around the world, those who long for rescue, they can taste this. They know the disappointment when all of your hopes are pinned on rescue and then they're gone. But we've all stood at a hospital bed near the end, by a casket, or at a graveside, in a courtroom, or a lawyer's office, on the other side of a doctor's desk. We've tasted the depth of loss and disappointment, haven't we? On some level, we can identify with Mary on some level. And while the disciples returned to safety, she remained. Perhaps she, more than the rest of them, had lost the most. She was undone and she didn't have anything left to live for. John says, as she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and she saw two angels in white standing where the body of Jesus had been lying, one at the head, the other at the feet. They said to her, "Woman," that's an endearing term in Greek, "woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they have laid him." Where were the angels when Peter and John looked in? Were they just not there? Or were they there, but they couldn't see them? Maybe angels are more easily seen through tears. Maybe God is more easily glimpsed from a place of sorrow. I don't know. But as witnesses and participants in this story, we stand there with Mary, grief-stricken and confused. We stand there with her in her loss and in her sorrow. And with her we say, they have taken away my, and we fill in the blank. They have taken away my spouse, my home, my career, my health, my child, my dignity, my innocence, my dreams of a particular future. The world's grief is concentrated here in Mary's grief. She weeps for all of us at the death of hope, and we weep with her. So let's stand with Mary just a little while longer. John says, when she had said this to the angels, she turned around and she saw Jesus standing there, but she didn't know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to her, woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for? Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've laid him, and I will take him away. Yes, me. I'll carry his body. I'll drag his body. I'll do whatever it takes to reclaim his body. I'm that desperate. Twice now she's been asked, why are you weeping? She was probably ready to scream. Don't ask me that again. As she turns, though, we turn. And she sees a strange figure, the gardener, one of the lowliest and lowest paid positions in the social order of first century Judea. Do you see the consistency of Jesus? He's still embodying humility even after the resurrection. He's not gone to Pilate's palace decked out in purple victorious garb. It's what I would have done, if I'm honest. Wouldn't that have been fun? Like, think about it. Showing up in Pilate's palace. Na, 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 na. How do you like me now? I think it would have been fun. Ultimate vindication. But she mistakes him for the gardener. Of course, we're in the garden. And indeed, this ancient gardener has come back. The creator of the first garden has come back to this garden. The drama is being played out. The drama of creation is being reenacted. There's a powerful message here. The so what of the resurrection. The gardener is in the garden to set the garden, to set creation right. What Mary thought was the end was actually a new beginning. What is John telling us here? Jesus is alive, but so what? John is telling us this is nothing short of a new creation, a new beginning. God is relaunching creation. And while it was still dark, new life. On the first day of the week, new creation. The ancient gardener is recreating, bringing creation to life, just as the Spirit birthed the first creation. Life from chaos and darkness and death. We can all get wrapped up in the legitimacy of the resurrection and the how and the proof of it and miss the whole point. God in Jesus is relaunching creation right in the middle of the old one. In the midst of death. I love this picture. It kind of captures, in the midst of a burned out forest, life. God didn't destroy the whole earth and start over, but God is recreating with the very stuff of the first creation, the very good stuff of the first garden. And we're called to take up that recreation project, to carry it forward. And where we failed to steward the first creation, we're invited again to partner in the new creation, in the power of God's creating spirit. The spirit that hovered and animated that first creation is now available to us. We do this not from a place of power and authority, but humility and service like the gardener, serving creation, serving each other. And I wonder, have we learned anything yet from our first creation experience, from our failure to steward this world well? The resurrection of Jesus is a sign that victory over brokenness and death was won where? on a cross. Friends, we can't ever forget that. Victory was won on a cross through death in humility. That's our template. Bottom line, Paul said this in 1 Corinthians, and if Christ has not been raised, then all of our preaching is useless and your faith is useless. It's useless. We're doomed to fate and entropy and death because without the resurrection, how can we believe that God will put everything right? Where's the evidence that God will in fact do this? How can we believe that there will be a time when there are no tears and sorrow, when there's no sickness and death? And there's no bedsides or gravesides. The resurrection is a down payment. The new creation will reach its fulfillment. The world is forgiven and creation has been reset. In the Bible, life started in a garden and it ends in a garden city. And in the middle is another garden where a woman weeps while it's still dark. But in the midst of her weeping, Jesus said to her, Mary. And she turned and she said to him in Hebrew, Rabboni, which means teacher. And Jesus said to her, don't touch me because I've not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers. Look at this shift in relationship. If you've noticed it all through the Gospels, Jesus calls his disciples, disciples, followers, friends, servants. Here he calls them brothers. And say to them, I'm ascending to my Father and your Father. Oh, look at the intimacy of that relationship. To my God and your God. Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, I've seen the Lord. And she told them that he had said these things to her. Paralyzed by grief, Mary didn't know what else to do. Where else to go but to the grave. To tend his body. To be near what remained. The Jesus she had known was dead, and all that she'd believed and hoped for died with him. So early on a Sunday morning, on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, before there was any hint of light or hope, she comes. She comes in the darkness of her despair to mourn the death of a friend and the death of her faith. And what she encounters in the midst of ashes and the stench of death is life. Life. Jesus himself. And he calls her by name. This isn't an abstract theology. Jesus calls her by name. He meets us in the pit of lost hope. He calls her by name. And instantly she knows when she hears her name that all will be well, somehow, some way, someday. And just as a by the way, if this story was made up, a woman would never have had the starring role. Because in the first century Judea, they weren't even allowed it. Their testimony wasn't even admissible in court. They were considered unreliable. But back to our so what question. Even if it's true, Jesus rose from the dead, so what? We look around, creation is full of sorrow and sickness, still. Tragedy and violence, still. Resurrection is the promise that God is putting everything right and calling us to join in that resurrection project. From the very beginning, God's desire was to dwell among us in relationship in this creation. We're not just a passing through. We're not just escaping earth and going somewhere else. God is making all things new here. And earth will be flooded with the presence of God and the goodness and the flourishing of God. And while this is a future hope, God is working in the present. God is beginning to put things right here. God is meeting us in our lack of hope, our lack of faith, in our despair, in our loss, in our pain. We can find Jesus there, even if we, like Mary, don't recognize him at first. Jesus is there with us in the midst of all of that. The basic story of the whole Bible, from Genesis to Revelation, is not how humans find our way to God, that's impossible, but how God comes to us, to live with us, to become one of us, to take on all the horror that we can inflict and redeem it. The resurrection is the ultimate redemption story, life out of death, joy out of sorrow, hope out of despair. I'm really excited. Next week, we're going to hear a testimony from one of our Lakesiders who, this is their story. Life out of death, hope out of despair. Jesus is alive and active today, friends, today. There's a magnificent declaration at the end of the Bible where in a vision the author hears Christ say, look, God's home is now among God's people. God will live with them and they will be God's people. God will be with them. God will wipe every tear from their eyes and there will be no more death or sorrow or crying or pain. All these things are gone forever. Creation is made right. Jesus' resurrection affirms this is how it will be. God with us with God, creation renewed. So what? Creation will be renewed. While I'm not giving proof today, the world does need proof. The world needs proof of the resurrection, but the proof doesn't come from airtight academic arguments or scholarly debates or archaeological evidence or questionable shrouds. That's not where we find the evidence of the resurrection. It comes as how we live. Do we live the truth of the resurrection, the reality of this new creation? As we bring peace where there's conflict and healing where there's sickness and comfort where there's sorrow and truth where there's lies and humility where there's pride and love where there's hate. That's our mandate. And let's be honest, the church has not always done a very good job of that, of living the resurrection. We preferred to argue about it because living it is harder. Living it requires us to follow the way of Jesus, the way of humility, the gardener, the cross, the way of humility and death. Living it requires faith that what we see is not ultimately what will be. Faith that Jesus is there beside us in the dark, in death, calling our name. It is finished, Christ cried from the cross. Christ is risen. He is risen indeed. That was Mary's truth. It was the truth of the church for 2,000 years. And these witnesses that we have looked at are passing the baton to us. Resurrection is our truth. Resurrection is our promise. Resurrection is our calling. And the challenge of Easter is this: can we go in the promise of the resurrection as living proof of the resurrection, being agents of a new creation? Can we, friends? Can we? Will we? If you're new, if you're wondering about this Jesus, if you want to know more about this Jesus, please don't leave here without talking to one of us. We have a prayer team that will be meeting at the front. I'll be in the atrium. Our other pastors will be there. This is our calling. This is our mandate. This is the hope of the world. Christ is risen, and he is risen indeed, and what we see is not the ultimate reality. Again, our prayer team's at the front if you want prayer for anything. I'd love to close us today with a benediction and bless us as we go, as people of the resurrection. Now to God, who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to God's power that is at work within us, to God be glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen. Go in peace, go in resurrection power. And happy Easter.
Thanks for spending time with us today. If this message was helpful to you, please consider passing it on, giving it a like, or supporting our work so we can continue to provide more great content. And if you're looking for a church to call home, whether in person or online, we'd love to connect. Head to lakesidechurch.ca to find out how you can get involved. Thanks again for being with us. We'll see you next time.